Good afternoon to you. It's a Juno afternoon here. I'm Andy Klein with you today, and we've got a really fun show and a full show today talking to folks from Perseverance Theater who are in their current production of Mice and Men, getting fantastic reviews and packed houses. Also going to be talking to folks from Hospice Volunteer Training, and that's something that starts on October 13th. We'll be talking to them about that. Mr. Stinky Feet will be here. No, not me. It's Jim Cosgrove. He is going to be coming to town and doing a fun fundraiser for Juno Montessori, and we'll be talking to him on the phone. Also, Sea Alaska and Central Council are doing a voter registration event, and we're going to be talking to them about a really cool thing of getting folks to vote and getting folks registered to vote. It's all coming up on a Juno afternoon. But first, here is National Native News.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Colorado Congresswoman Diana DeGitt says financial woes in Washington pose a threat to the future of a diabetes program. As KUNC's Kirk Sigler reports, she spoke this week at the National Indian Health Board Conference in Denver.
Rates of diabetes among American Indian and Alaska Natives are disproportionately higher than the national average. The Special Diabetes Program for Indians is a $2 billion federal effort that began in the late 1990s to try to curb that trend. SDPI funds prevention and treatment programs and medical research in 35 states. Congresswoman DeGette co-sponsored the bill when it was first created. Now she's urging for its reauthorization, making the pitch that it will eventually curb health care costs for everyone.
The bad news is, in case you haven't noticed, this is one of the most partisan Congresses ever. That's the bad news. The good news is this doesn't seem to spill over to diabetes issues in general.
DeGette says that's because it's hard to find someone who doesn't know someone else who's affected by diabetes, including her own daughter. She and a small bipartisan group of lawmakers plan to request $200 million for the program over the next 5 years when Congress reconvenes in a lame duck session after the election. The SDPI is set to expire in September of next year. For National Native News, I'm Kirk Sigler in Denver.
Canadian police announce a major break in a series of disappearances and murders along a British Columbia highway, Lisa Hale reports.
People call it the Highway of Tears. Stretches of northern roads where dozens of women have gone missing or have been found murdered since 1969. Many of the victims are women from remote First Nations communities who were last seen hitchhiking in a part of the province that has little in the way of transport options, particularly for people living on reserve. Yesterday, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police announced that they have solved at least one of 18 cases they have been investigating since 2005. A DNA sample from the 1974 murder of Colleen McMillan, last seen hitchhiking near Lac La Hache, has been matched to a man who died in an Oregon prison 6 years ago. Bobby Jack Fowler, a transient who sometimes worked construction, was known for charm that could suddenly turn to violence. He frequented bars and routinely picked up hitchhikers. Fowler had a long record of sexual assaults and violent incidents and was imprisoned in Oregon for kidnapping, attempted rape, and assault in 1996. Now he's being linked to McMillan's murder and is a person of interest in 10 of the Highway of Tears cases. Oregon officials are also drawing links to unsolved murders of young women in 1992 and 1995 in Lincoln County. Police in BC and the U.S. are now asking the public for any information about Bobby Jack Fowler's movements in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. They are asking anyone who might have known him or encountered him to call law enforcement or Crime Stoppers. For National Native News, I'm Lisa Hale in Vancouver.
A memorial service is being held today for Athabascan elder Richard Frank from Old Minto, Alaska. He was a tribal leader who worked to preserve the Native way of life and a World War II Army veteran who founded the Alaska Native Veterans Association. Frank also helped establish the Fairbanks Native Association and worked closely with the Tanana Chiefs Conference. His daughter Roxanne says he was outspoken about Native land claims.
He was part of the, I would say, the pack, not only with Minto, but Rampart and Stevens Village, who kind of had the land freeze to deal with the issue of lands here in Alaska.
He's survived by 4 children and 8 grandchildren, including granddaughter Amanda, who says he valued education.
In my apartment, I have a study area, and I kept a picture of him there. And every time I felt discouraged at school, I just look at that picture and remember that this is what he wanted. he needed someone to fill the shoes and continue on with his legacy.
Frank passed away last week at the age of 85. During this month in 2004, the National Museum of the American Indian opened its doors in Washington, D.C. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Well, the new Perseverance Theater production is Mice and Men, the John Steinbeck classic. And I've got two of the principals here. Dick Reichman is with me. Dick, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And also Charles Branklin. Charles, thank you to you as well.
Yes, thank you very much.
Let me get you guys just to describe who you're playing in the play. So,
I'm playing Dick. A character named Candy. If you remember the book, those of you who've read it, there's a guy who introduces Lenny and George, the two lead characters, to the bunkhouse, brings them in there, and eventually his dog, who's a very old dog, gets shot, and it's very sad. And it's a wonderful part, beautiful.
Always sad when dogs are in plays. It's almost always sad. Dogs, you know.
Yeah, it's a terrific acting part, though. It's just a great thing to do.
And Charles, what part are you playing?
I'm playing the black in the play. His name is Crooks, and I consider Crooks the underdog in all the dogs that are in the play, primarily in a way that that Crooks get an opportunity to turn the table on Lenny and abuse him in a way, and to scare him, and to rip in his sense of his companion to George, like how to put a wedge between George and his dependency on Lenny, or Lenny's put a wedge in front of Lenny in his dependency on George. So my character has been brought into the play to sort of make Lenny look at things that he wouldn't ordinarily want to see, which is a desperate life of loneliness and rejection and ostracism.
Themes from Steinbeck.
Hey.
Right? I mean, those are...
Yeah, what's interesting is these characters, because the themes are so intense and Steinberg is such a great author and his people are so real, makes it a wonderful acting experience. It's a deeper role than you usually get.
Yeah, what are some of the challenges you find behind being in a play that's such a well-known piece of literature that people are so familiar with?
Well, you just try to do the best job you can. I think people, I don't think there's any particular challenge. People come to see it because they know it and love it. You just want to be truthful enough and do it well enough so they don't feel disappointed.
I guess in some ways I'm thinking of especially the two lead actors. There's probably a preconceived notion people have about what George should be like, what Lenny should be like, that kind of thing. That I think, and because it's such a well-known work, and the other, you know, people have a mental image of what they're thinking those characters must be like, and then as an actor, you have to bring yourself into that as well.
Well, often the actor creates that mental image in people, and if you have a really good actor, he'll change it for you. I think we got two people playing Lenny and George, and I haven't watched the movies lately because I didn't want to. I'm going to watch them as soon as this is over. We've got two actors playing Lenny and George who look so natural in those parts. If you don't envision somebody like those two guys in it, you will when you leave. Mm. They're good.
Charles, have you not watched the movies lately, or have you watched, or is that something that entered your mind?
That was nothing that I was concerned about because I had done this play in Northern California as late as April. We started rehearsing in this play the 14th of February, 2012. So obviously Art had seen the work that I did on stage and invited me to come to do the play.
Now, that's an interesting thing. I didn't know that. And,
yeah.
And so what's the challenge of bringing the same, and it's the same role that you're in?
It's the same role.
What's the challenge of bringing that role to a whole new cast and a whole new production?
Well, It's a smaller theater, which gives it a kind of filmic sense to me in terms of space and time. There's always new actors that you are feeding off of, and you can obviously not realize that you're working with someone entirely new. So all the tricks that I had as an actor in the production that I did previously had to go outside the window because suddenly you're in a new situation.
Can you just expound on that a little bit? When you say actor's tricks, what do you...
What I mean by actor's tricks, I mean if you work at something long enough, and I would say that you gain a kind of toolbox of things that you rely on to convey certain sense of whether it's joy or sorrow, how to intimidate somebody, or whatever the task may be that you have as an actor, you have accumulated a certain set of skills in which you use in your working, whether it's what part of your voice you're using, what part of your body you're using. So we are always being challenged to find parts of us that may not fit the role that you have to step aside and let that lay. But they are parts of you as a human being that you should tap into. And when that happens, you can use that. I think primarily it's almost like how to use yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And how not to have such habitual aspects of yourself that you're just not exciting even to yourself or other people. Mm. And that's what I mean by tricks of the trade.
Yeah.
I mean, they're subtle things. They're not huge things. They are subtle things that are complementary to what it is you're attempting to do as an actor.
Now, Dick, how was it to act with someone who had so recently been in this play, so familiar with this play? Was that something that was, I'm guessing that was something that would be great, but maybe there's parts of that that's maybe a little intimidating, or maybe it's a little, you know, how was that?
Well, it really didn't come into my mind. What really began to come into my mind working with some of these people, Charles is a very accomplished actor. He's been doing this for a lot of time, and he's got huge experience behind him. So I just enjoy watching a guy who's really handy at the trade. And he's not the only one in the play. So for me, it's been, I hope I'm at that level. I try to be, but I'm watching other people do beautiful work. And it's terrific. I've done a number of shows at Perseverance, and they've all been wonderful experiences because I worked with really gifted people who worked hard and did it right.
It's amazing, actually. I mean, we are always marveling at that. Here we are in this small town, and we have this theater company that just is fantastic.
Yeah, it's too big for Juno.
Yeah, you were saying that it's a little bit, it's a different stage. What's the audience experience like, and how does that differ here at Perseverance from what you've recently experienced?
Well, you're talking about a theater that's very small, as opposed to one that has a balcony and seat, 650 people? A stage that's proscenium. The stage is higher than people are sitting in the front. Here in Perseverance, it's like sitting in someone's front room. You could easily be sitting in someone's front room, and you are a part. People could touch you. And to think that you wouldn't have to emote and be declarative and just sort of be big. It's a very subtle place to work, and I enjoy it very much that kind of atmosphere exists in this play that allow you to see how different it can be and just how powerful it can be in some subtle kinds of ways. And that's what attracts me to it. I'm glad I showed up.
Seems like it's been an energizing kind of experience for you, the way you're speaking about it.
It has enabled me to see that it's not all about strutting and shouting. You know, I mean, I can't say that I wasn't faulted for relying on things in the rehearsal process, but as the play began to move toward opening night, I realized that I hadn't even infused the scene yet with the kind of subtleness that's there. So I'm still mining, essentially. I'm still finding things to do that can reinforce the character what is there about. So.
And you guys opened last weekend. Is that the opening? The opening weekend was last weekend. Is that right?
We've run two weekends.
Oh, two weekends. Is that right?
Two more.
Yeah.
And you've got two more. Okay. And yeah. Do you still feel that what you're saying to me? It's interesting. I often think of. I mean, I've never been in a play. I've done a little production work,
yes.
And so I've seen how it works. And I've always had the idea that, oh, well, the actors, you know, they rehearse, get it to opening night, and then it's just in a hermetically sealed box and the performances don't change, you know. And how is that? I mean, I guess it sounds like it constantly evolves. Maybe that's an obvious statement, but.
Yeah, it's like performing music, like singing a song, like any kind of performance. You make a connection, hopefully, with the audience, and you create the moment afresh and anew. It's interesting, Charles, talking about size, though. I come from Cyrano's Theater in Anchorage. I've done a lot of work there for the last 20 years. A smaller theater. It's a 100-seat black box, little tiny theater. Some folks will know it from. So when I go to Perseverance, I got to pump it up. Charles is cutting it down. I'm pumping it up. Because
right.
I'm used to working in really movie acting situations.
Right, right.
And it's even smaller theater.
Well, let's do the nuts and bolts. You got a couple more weekends? Tell folks when they can see it and all those things.
You know, this show is selling quite well. And what happens with us when we run a show for 4 weeks, and it probably happens here too, is that everybody wants till the last weekend to come. And then, of course, you turn away people on the last weekend, and of course the weekend before that, which is this coming weekend, you have extra seats. So if you're going to see the show, folks, and a lot of people out there are putting it off to the last minute, consider this weekend too, because you may not get in next weekend. We play Thursday through Sunday evenings at 7:30, and that's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday this weekend. Next weekend we play Thursday through Saturday in the evening, and we have a final matinee on Sunday afternoon. So that is
that's great.
Eight more shows. Come and see it.
And what's your assessment of the show so far? I mean, how are you thinking it's how do you feel about it?
I feel that the show is realizing what it is that Steinbeck had given to us, and I feel like the play itself stands on its feet and it speaks in a way that has an authenticity to it that is very, very effective. And I see no slowing down of the play. It's a moving entity, and it's organic. And I would at all costs see the show before it closes, unless you happen to be able to go to Anchorage and see it again. And that will be another situation.
And the play is then moving up to Anchorage.
Yeah, we do a couple of
weekends
in Anchorage in a larger theater still, about twice the size of Perseverance. So we'll be moving into the kind of theater that Charles is used to.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah. It'll be like old home week for you there. Yeah, well, yeah. Charles Branklin, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it. And Dick Reichman, again, the play is Of Mice and Men. It's Perseverance Theater's production of it. It's playing for the next two weekends, Thursday through Sunday, with a special Sunday matinee the next weekend as the final performance. Thanks so much. I appreciate you guys coming in.
Thank you.
It's Of Mice and Men. It's playing right now. Forecast for the rest of the day. You can probably guess it's going to be rain. Rain tonight, heavy at times, and showers tomorrow. I guess that's an uptick. An optimistic uptick, a good thing. Showers or lighter rains with highs around 49 degrees for tomorrow. Same forecast going out throughout Saturday night, through the weekend. Rain likely and showers likely through the weekend. Next in the studio with me are two folks here from Hospice, and they're the two volunteer coordinators of Hospice Home Care. It's Gary Weglars and Colleen Jones. I said Hospice Home Care. Is that correct? Maybe I'm adding words there. Juno Hospice.
Juno Hospice and Home Care.
And Home Care.
That's
okay.
Correct.
Hey, okay. All right. I've got it right. Now, you guys have a really interesting volunteer training program coming up. Tell me a little bit about what's going to be happening. October 13th, I think.
We're going to begin the program on October 13th. It's going to run for three consecutive Saturdays. So that'll be the 13th, the 20th, and the 27th. And from 8 o'clock in the morning till 4 p.m. And these three training sessions are to prepare people, volunteers, to be able to go into the homes of our hospice patients and provide care, typically respite care, maybe allowing a family member to get out of the house, so sitting with one of our patients, although there's really a wide range of types of volunteer activities that we'd like to talk about today. The training is going to focus on really helping people be prepared to do that in-home training or that in-home care.
Right. And Colleen, do you feel like people have a misperception? Is there a common misperception about what it takes to be a hospice volunteer that you find people have?
Oh, good question. I don't know what their perceptions really are, but I think it's a difficult place in people's lives, and so there's a lot of fear and anxiety, I think, around that. But to be a volunteer, I think you just have to be sincere and caring and open and just a willing, person to be sitting there by somebody and have a level of comfort with that.
And is that the training is kind of provides you some tools that allow you to have that level of comfort? Is that the idea behind?
It is. The training is really going to blend kind of interactive experiences where in small groups and with three facilitators, we'll really try to help people think about, talk about, and really work with the kinds of fears that we carry in this culture around death and dying, maybe our own grief histories, so that when we reach a point as a volunteer that we're able to go into a home, we're kind of comfortable and familiar with our feelings. It doesn't mean that we won't struggle at times, but we've kind of talked about, thought about, and shared with others about some of the things that we are going to encounter.
So as part of what you do, you kind of act out scenarios or play out scenarios and things like that? Is that what's going on?
We will do some of that type of thing, and we will also have a number of presenters who come in, various members of the hospice team and other individuals from the community to speak about kind of areas of specialization such as dementia, and we will have someone come in and speak in depth about grief and complex grief. So it's going to be really a wide range of experiences and I think a really exciting training opportunity, regardless of whether at the end of this training a person feels like they want to do in-home training. I think people will come away enriched if they participate.
And yeah, I mean, it's difficult, right? I mean, a lot of it is sort of difficult. You have to be prepared to say, okay, I need to be ready to handle some of the biggest things that can happen, and that must be something to really to really get through with people kind of right off the bat. Like here we go, now we're going to talk about this. It's one of those things that people typically are used to not talking about, right? I mean, that's
I think that's exactly true, and our culture in particular maybe it seems that there's an aura around death and dying, and yet I think working in hospice, this is the fourth program that I've worked with over the years as a social worker. I think working with hospice and working with dying patients and with their families has done more to enrich my life and change the way I live than any other type of work I've done. And I think that's kind of the beauty of hospice work and the opportunity to volunteer in hospice. This is where we all come together. We all die, no matter what our political beliefs, religious beliefs. So all of the differences that we use to separate ourselves, race, ethnicity, they all kind of fall away at the end of our life. And I take great inspiration from the idea that if we can come together as a community and support each other and overlook all these differences at the end of life, you know, maybe it opens the door that we can do that in before the end of life, and that we can kind of create a more humane, just society overall.
Is there a big stumbling block? I mean, do you think fear, is that the thing that people deal with most, or is it, you know, not just maybe fear of death, but fear of how they're going to react to this sort of thing? Is that what you feel like?
Now, are you talking about people
for people who are thinking about volunteers, or people that you kind of, you know, or people who are involved in the hospice program on the volunteer on a volunteer level?
I think that fear is a big thing for us, for all of us around death. You know, I can think about even though I've worked in hospice for years, my best friend got a cancer diagnosis several years ago. And a number of fears came up for me about losing, you know, a friend who I've had for 30 years potentially from this illness. So even though I'd worked with so many people who had experienced the same thing, once it comes home to us, it touches parts of us that that are scary, because we're all going to lose people around us and eventually, you know, our own lives. And so, again, I think that the strength of the training piece is we really work with that piece, and we're open to it, and we acknowledge. So if you're out there listening and you're considering this, and you do have some fears about, you know, what would I say, what would I do if I was trying to support someone who's dying, that's going to be what this training is about. Is really talking about and kind of facing some of those things so that we come to a place where we realize that we can't fix the situation, but we can walk with people, we can support people, we can be there with people at a time when that kind of support is really, really important.
It's interesting, because you think, I mean, there can be not a more helpless feeling in the world, right? I mean, you're absolutely powerless to keep this thing that's happening from happening about people that you care the most about, mm-hmm. often. And I mean, that's that thing as well. I also often think of, especially in this society, there's so much focus on gain. You know, we're trying to gain friends and gain power and gain. And then when we lose things uncontrollably, lose friends or lose family members, it's like, how do you, you know, we're not built to deal with that in this society right now. Right. So how many people do you typically get in these training, you know, programs, or how many people are you hoping to get for this?
You know, I'm so new to the organization that I really don't know what they've had in the past, but I'm thinking we're hoping to get a good 20 or more new volunteers. Gary, I don't know if you, we would just love to see some new interested people in the community that want to partake in that.
Are there 20 volunteers at any one time that are out and doing hospice? And, Juno, what's the typical kind of like workload that's out there of hospice at any one time? Are there 10 cases happening and that sort of thing, or is there some sort of you know, number like that?
It varies tremendously. Our census in hospice can vary between 3, 5 to 12 patients at mm-hmm. any given time. But that really brings up a good point that we wanted to talk about, which is the kind of variety of volunteer training opportunities there are, or volunteer opportunities, I should say. So besides the in-home volunteering, we're a small program, and so we don't we often don't have enough bodies to cover everything that really needs getting done. And the area of equipment, delivering a hospital bed, putting it up, taking it down. Right now we've got one person who's been really a volunteer doing the bulk of that. We'd love to kind of beef up that program and have a small team of people that are able to do that. And I know Colleen has volunteers that help with events and fundraising.
Yeah, we have, you know, kind of a special event, kind of volunteer piece where people that want to still be connected with hospice but not necessarily in the home, because we do a lot of fundraising and we rely very heavily on that. We have three major fundraisers throughout the year, and Light Up a Life is coming up, and a lot of mailing and sitting at the mall, and people that are interested in taking part in that.
Yeah, we in public radio know about fundraising.
Exactly.
We know it's a lot of energy.
And you guys are the masters of it. So we have that one coming up. We also have a fun run in April, and that's really fun and
yeah,
small.
I have friends, the Yorbas, that help put that together, and yeah, they're really involved in that.
And then we have a whale watch cruise that we put on in the summer, and it's very fun, but it relies on volunteers to help make that take place and run smoothly for all of them. So I'm kind of more in charge of the fundraising, special projects, volunteers, and I would be glad to have anybody call me if they're interested.
what number can they call you at?
Our number is 463-6111 is the front desk, and they can connect you with Gary or myself.
Okay.
But that's the main number to call.
And this training is coming up on October 13th. It's a three-week training course on the weekends. Is that right? Is that how it's?
That's right. It's going to run for three consecutive Saturdays, the 13th, the 20th, and the 27th.
And once again, it's a Juno Hospice and Home Care, and it's a training exercise, all kinds of different ways you can help volunteer, and this training is just a great first step towards figuring out how you might want to volunteer, how you might want to be involved in this really worthy, great program.
Correct.
Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thanks for
really
having
appreciate us.
Thank
it.
You very much.
Coming up next, we've got Writer's Almanac. Here's Garrison Keillor.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, September the 26th, 2012. It's the birthday of Thomas Stearns Eliot, born in St. Louis, 1888, who at the age of 27 wrote the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, and at the age of 34 wrote The Wasteland. Somebody once said to T.S. Eliot that most editors are failed writers. Eliot said, yes, so are most writers. It's the birthday of the novelist Jane Smiley, born in Los Angeles, 1949, parents divorced. When she was quite young, she went to live with her mother, who was a journalist, on the outskirts of St. Louis. Went to Vassar, started writing while she was teaching English at Iowa State University. And in the last 30 years, she's written about horse training and the Iraq War, about motherhood, a distant relative obsessed with discrediting Einstein. In 1992, she published her novel, A Thousand Acres, a sort of retelling of King Lear from the perspective of two sisters living with the fallout of their abusive father. Most recent novel, Private Life, following the lives of Margaret Mayfield and her husband, Andrew Early, a brilliant scientist who gradually becomes unhinged as he descends into delusional competition with fellow scientists. Jane Smiley, who lives now in Northern California, where she teaches classes in horse training. She says, as soon as you're riding horses seriously, you're being disciplined on a daily basis on how ignorant you are and how much there is left for you to learn. The great thing is that the fun gets greater as you get better, and there's no glass ceiling. It's the birthday of the composer George Gershwin, born Jacob Gershwin in Brooklyn, 1898, middle child in a family of Russian Jewish immigrants. His father bought a piano for Ira Gershwin, the brother, and George sat right down and started to play. At 15, he left school to work on Tin Pan Alley as a song plugger, as sort of a house musician for the music companies. Started writing his own songs, wrote a big hit called Swanee, and then with his brother Ira began composing Broadway musicals, Funny Face and Strike Up the Band. At the age of 25, he wrote Rhapsody in Blue, later An American in Paris, and then his folk opera Porgy and Bess in 1935. In 1936, Porgy and Bess played at the National Theater in Washington, D.C., And the last performance was integrated. It was the first ever integrated show at that theater. Here's a poem for today by Richard Wilbur, entitled In Trackless Woods. In trackless woods, it puzzled me to find four great rock maples, seemingly aligned, as if they had been set out in a row before some house a century ago, to edge the property and lend some shade. I looked to see if ancient wheels had made old ruts to which the trees ran parallel, but there were none, so far as I could tell. There'd been no roadway, nor could I find the square depression of a cellar anywhere. And so I tramped on further to survey amazing patterns in a hornbeam spray or spirals in a pine cone under trees not subject to our stiff geometries. Richard Wilbur's poem In Trackless Woods, from his collected poems 1943 to 2004, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
I know a girl named Erin. She's happy, and she's dancing on her head. I know a boy named Michael. He's happy, and he's dancing on his head.
Happy, happy, we're all happy. Happy, happy, and we're dancing on our heads.
I know a girl, Paprika. She's goofy, and she's hopping on one leg. I know a boy named Maxwell. He's goofy, and he's hopping on one leg.
Goofy, goofy, we're all goofy. Goofy, goofy, and we're hopping on one leg.
I know a girl named Maddie. She's wacky, and she repeats everything I've said. He's wacky, and he repeats everything I've said.
I'm wacky, and I repeat everything he said.
Wacky, wacky, we're all wacky. Wacky, wacky, and repeat everything he said.
I know a hiccup named Mark. He's noisy, and he's banging on his drums.
Do you know a hiccup named Terrence? Well, I don't either, but Mr. Stinky Feet sure does. He's Jim Cosgrove. He's on the phone with me right now. Jim, thanks so much for joining us here on a Juno afternoon.
Hey, you bet. It's a pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
And I know you're going to be playing a concert that a lot, especially of kids and families, are really looking forward to, happening Sunday at the JDHS Auditorium here in Juno. And it's part of a kind of a Northwest tour you're doing. Is that right?
Well, that's right. We got a show in Seattle on Friday night, and then we'll be heading up your way Saturday afternoon, and then playing there on Sunday afternoon.
And you got the Great Alaska Tour, yes.
Yeah. Oh, man, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a kick.
I know you've got
I assume you guys like to rock up there, so.
We've been known to rock. We've been known to let loose up here in Juneau.
Good.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me, just let folks know a little. Obviously, you do great, fun, silly, and goofy, and great children's songs. Let people know just a little bit, if they're not familiar with what you've done before, kind of what a show might be like that they'd go to.
Yeah, well, my if people often ask about my show and what it entails, and I'm not the star of the show is my first premise, and the kids are the stars of the show, not me. And I do my best to get as many kids up involved, that is on stage with me, as I possibly can, and to get the audience singing and dancing together. And one of my focuses too is on getting the family together, that it's not just about kids singing kids' music, it's about families making music and having fun together.
Sounds great, man. It couldn't be a better thing. There's so many great families in Juneau. It's a great place to raise a kid, I'll tell you that. I've raised a kid here, and it's a lot of fun.
Cool.
Yeah. So is there a lot of audience participation and that sort of thing in your shows?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Not only singing along and dancing, but we put together, I always carry travel with instruments, and we put together impromptu jam sessions. So I bring kids up on stage to play instruments with me, and percussion instruments, and we do a little jamming together and do some dancing. And I usually like to pull somebody up to sing with me, too.
Very good. Yeah, you could discover a child prodigy that way. Maybe.
Yeah, I believe me, I've met more phenomenal singers since I've been doing this.
Yeah, I'll bet. And boy, I'm sure kids are going to love it. Run through just like some of your favorite songs, maybe the fun titles of some of your favorite songs that you've done through the years.
Oh, well, Stinky Feet seems to be a popular one. And it's the song that gave me my name. And that's not a name I came up with, by the way. Kids just started calling me Mr. Stinky Feet after that song. So there's that. But I've got a song called The Buggy Hop, which is a good rock and roll tune that the kids jam on. We've got, another one called Slug Bug, which is a dancing song. I got a song about peanut butter and pickles and cookies and
all good staples of children's diets. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, got it. Yeah.
I also see I've got your CD in front of me, Ooey Gooey, here, and
that
we're gonna play Ooey Gooey in just a second as well. But I also like this Wiggle Wobble Tooth. That's a good one. Where do you come up with the inspiration for your songs?
Well, I pull them from my own childhood, but I also I have two daughters, so they give me a lot of material. And they'll be with me, too. I have a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old, and they usually perform with me at some point during the show, if they're up for it. And through the years, I'm also the uncle of, 15 nieces and nephews, and so they've been the source of a lot of that, too.
Some of them right here in Juneau.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
My brother Tom lives in Juneau, and he's got two kids.
Yeah,
so we're very excited to see our cousins. My daughters are really pumped to hang out with their cousins.
Those cold Alaskan cousins, that's right.
Yes, they love it. They're cool, man. They're all cool up there.
Well, the other thing I noticed is that there's a couple of songs in here that might, they're ooey gooey. The grossness. Kids love gross.
Well, frankly, I really kind of steer away from gross.
Okay.
I know they sound gross, but I mean, it may border on that, but I always feel like that's kind of a cheap trick.
Yeah.
So I stay away from. I mean, even though they call me Mr. Stinky Feet, we use that as a lesson. And again, that's a name that kids start to call me. I use that as a lesson to remind people that, hey, we've all got stinky. Everybody's got stinky feet.
Yeah, hey, come on.
No big deal. We're all in this together,
right?
We're
all the same inside our shoes.
That's right. You got it.
That's right. Well, Jim Cosgrove, better known as Mr. Stinky Feet, he's going to be performing Sunday. That's at JDHS Auditorium. It's a fundraiser for the Juneau Montessori School. And, Jim, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be seeing you on Sunday up here.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Okay, let's hear some ooey gooey right now.
Yeah, bring on the ooey gooey.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Bubblegum stuck on the bottom of my shoe. My, oh my, what am I gonna do? Ooey gooey, ooey goo. bubblegum stuck on the bottom of my shoe. If you were me, what would you do if you had bubblegum on your shoe? Ooey gooey, ooey goo, bubblegum stuck on the bottom of my shoe.
You could pick up the stick, give it a flick, hope it floats right down the creek.
Ooey gooey, ooey goo, bubblegum stuck on the bottom of my shoe.
Just pull it off and feed it to the cat.
Oh my gosh, I couldn't do that.
Ooey gooey, ooey goo, bubblegum stuck on the bottom of my shoe.
Bubblegum stuck on the bottom of my shoe. My, oh my, what am I gonna do? Ooey gooey, ooey goo, bubblegum stuck on the bottom of my shoe. If you were me, what would you do if you had bubblegum on your shoe? Ooey gooey, ooey goo, bubblegum stuck on the bottom of my shoe. Ooey ooey goo, bubblegum stuck on the bottom of my shoe.
Why don't you wipe it off on the neighbor's lawn, wrap it up and give it to your mom.
Ooey 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 goo, bubblegum stuck on the bottom of my shoe.
Beautiful song there from Liz Snyder, and Liz Snyder's going to be one of the people in the singer-songwriter showcase that's coming up tonight at the Gold Town Theater. It might be sold out. I'm not sure. You can show up at the door and see if you can get in. It's going to be $15 at the door. Liz Snyder, Brooke Morgan, Dean Frank, and Irene Muller are all going to be with Angelina, the great music host over from KRNN, and there'll be snacks on the house, and there's beer and wine for sale. It's a really fun event. Part of these KRNN concert music series, the KRNN Spotlight series, a really cool thing. I recommend it highly. All the ones I've been to have been fantastic. And Liz Snyder, great, great talent. And speaking of great talent, I'll tell you something. We're going to have a Battle of the Bands coming up. That's all gone to Cancer Connection, which is a great thing that Nicole Hollingstead has been involved with. Nicole.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm here for a separate issue, but
I know.
I'm always happy to plug Cancer Connection.
I know that, but that's why I didn't want to just say that and pretend like you weren't involved in that.
Cricket.
Yeah, you've been doing great stuff, and you're here with Melissa Kukesh, both from Sea Alaska and Central Council now. Is one of you from one and one from the other? Or what's... Tell
yes.
me about, okay.
Nicole here. I'm here with Sea Alaska.
And you're from Central Council.
Yes.
And Melissa, okay, great. And you guys are doing a really cool thing. Actually, KXLL is doing a similar thing, too, which is a registration drive for voters. So
awesome.
Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, we are actually working in conjunction to try to mobilize voters in Indian Country. There are nationwide voter registration events this week. It's sort of National Voter Registration Week. And we're trying to call attention to the importance of the vote. You know, people hear all the time that your vote represents your voice. And, you know, what that really means is there are policies that affect us every day. And the people who craft those policies are our elected officials. So if you want to actually have a say in affordable energy, in housing, in healthcare, in your community, you need to get registered to vote, and you need to get to the to
democracy.
The, yeah,
it's a wonderful thing, democracy. Yes. But you got to participate.
That's right.
To be part of it, right?
Yes.
I mean, and what we found when we're doing the KXLL, so we've done some fun things with KXLL. We set up a voter registration table at Pelmeni at midnight on a Saturday.
Ah, what a great
which is really
idea.
Fun. Now,
how are the signatures?
Right. So they're okay. Ones. And, you know, it's mostly like kids. And they're like, you know, they didn't think they were going to be registering to vote that night. I'll tell you that, right? They were out getting Pelmeni. But it's really fun to talk to young people, especially about voting. But you find there's a little bit of a disheartening disenfranchisement. Like, people just feel like they don't matter. So is there a message you're trying to give to people about, hey, you know, it may seem like you're one of a million people, but you kind of do matter, right?
So true. You know, we have a slogan that every Native vote counts. Every vote counts. And there are countless examples of instances, even in the state of Alaska, when literally a single vote swung the difference. There are also instances where a population voting as a block has swung very important elections. And so it matters that everybody turns out.
Yes, it does. And one of the things that we have discovered in Alaska that there are approximately 1 million Alaska Natives who are eligible to vote and are not registered. And one of our drives for this campaign has been to get the younger population to the polls. We'll get them registered to the polls, as well as the people who are registered, and get them to the polls as well, because we've noticed a trend in people being registered but not voting.
Not getting out to
vote.
Yeah,
not actually making that step to then vote, right?
Yeah, the turnout in the primary election was about 25%.
Yeah.
That can be disheartening when you're already
registered. Big issues at hand, too. You know, big
right.
issues at hand. I also think that's an interesting thing is that in Alaska, what's interesting is that in a way, your vote kind of counts more. There's
right.
not many of us in Alaska,
yes.
right? So that one vote, it's not like when you're in California and you're one of 30 million people. You know, you're one of maybe 100,000 people are going to vote that time around. That, you know, that's a big chunk of the, you know, you're really determining the fate of a lot of important issues.
That's
there's
right.
a lot in front of us right now.
And, you know, we sometimes get feedback when we go into communities and we do voter registration events where people say, you know, you're the first person who's ever asked me to register. And you tend to think that, you know, everybody knows their
right.
civic responsibilities, but we live really busy lives, and it never hurts to ask, are you registered to vote? Would you like to get registered?
Yeah.
We can do that for you.
And it's so easy is the
yes.
thing. Registering to vote is so easy.
It takes literally seconds to do it.
That's right.
Did
and
you guys go through the training with the Division of Elections to become a registrar?
Yes.
I know. I did that, too. It was easy.
Yeah.
One of our employees is, she recently signed up. She's 22, and she recently signed up to be registered. But then she became a registrar, and she's totally jumped on board and is going out to our community meetings that we're having for this election process, or getting out getting out people to register to vote. And so she's totally embraced it, and it's just an awesome experience.
So let's make sure that people know that they have an opportunity to do this at a voter registration rally. This is open to the public. Even though, of course, we're dedicated to mobilizing the Native vote, we want everybody to have this opportunity to come to a community event. There's going to be some refreshments. There will be door prizes.
Door
yes. prizes.
All
always
right.
a great draw. Well, a mileage ticket on Alaska
there
Airlines.
You go.
There
two
are going to be two of them.
Tickets.
That's
one from Sea Alaska,
yeah,
one from Clink and Haida. And so this event is going to be from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, September 27th, tomorrow, at the Elizabeth Paradovich Hall, which we sort of know as the A&B, mm-hmm. A&S Hall here in downtown Juneau.
Terrific. And tell me about the relationship between the organizations and how Sea Alaska and Central Council got together on this issue.
Well, it's tremendously important that we reach as many people as possible. Now, Sea Alaska has a pool of tribal member shareholders who are actually enrolled to the corporation. There is actually a much broader pool of Alaska Natives who are members
of Central Council. We have 28,000 tribal citizens worldwide, and I feel within Southeast we share, you know, the same population, same group of people, and our communities are the same, and just felt it was important that we, instead of you know, doing separate efforts to try to get out the vote for us to work together on this process.
And I think probably important to mention, you're not advocating they are any one particular party or any one particular political stance. You just want people to be involved citizens, make up their own minds on issues, but be prepared to vote by registering.
That's absolutely right. This is a nonpartisan event. We will have a wide variety of information available for the municipal election, any way we can help with information for the general election. We have resources. We can provide them with links and phone numbers, places to go to find out what they need to know to cast their ballot.
And you have to register to vote 30 days before an election occurs. So October 7th is actually the last day to register to vote for the general election. So this is a perfect event to go to right now if you're thinking, I really want to get involved with voting on these national issues, this stuff you're watching on the news all the time. Right now is the time. You've got to go register to vote and go do it. Right now, this week.
That's right. And here's another great thing about the rally. We're actually setting up mock ballot booths. If people are unfamiliar with the voting process, you know, the first time I went to vote, I was like, what do I do? Where do I
– there's a curtain involved? To go in there? What do you do?
So we'll have the booth set up. People can, you know, register to vote, and then they can go through the process of casting a mock ballot, get familiar with the process – you know, get a little bit of that fear and uncertainty out of it and just be ready to cast their ballot.
Sounds really cool. We'll see Alaskan Central Council getting together to have a voter registration event. It's happening tomorrow. It's at the A&B Hall, Elizabeth Paratovich. What's the full title?
Elizabeth Paratovich Hall.
Hall. Just Hall. Okay. Okay. When does it start tomorrow?
4 o'clock.
Okay,
starts at four o'clock.
Goes 4 to 8. There's door prizes. There's fun.
We'll have a multimedia station. You can take a picture, post it on Facebook right there. Let everybody know where you
are
and what you're doing.
Very cool.
We're
going to
have halibut chowder and fry bread and sisterhood stew.
Wait, you wait till now to mention the halibut chowder.
We're going to have dance groups. It's going to be
halibut
fun.
Halibut chowder. What more do you have to say?
Right.
What if you're already registered? Can you get a little halibut chowder?
Come on down. Get some information.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Very good. Very good. It's all happening tomorrow. Tomorrow starts at 4 o'clock. Thanks, you guys, for coming in. Nicole and Melissa, I really appreciate you guys coming in. Right now, we're going to hear from the New York Polyphony, who are going to be in town. Here's a little music from them. This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators, the Valley and Auk Bay area. Tune in to K276 AF 103.1 in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard at digital channel 872, and KXLL can be found at 873. We're also online at www.ktoo.org. And I just want to let folks know that the singer-songwriter showcase we're talking about that's happening tonight, 9 o'clock, Go Town Theater, there are still tickets available for that. You can still go online if you want, or there's the tickets going to be available at the door. Online, you can go to krnn.org. You can go at the door. There'll be $15. Liz Snyder, Brooke Morgan, Dean Frank, and Irene Muller, fantastic, talented singer-songwriter, is going to be there tonight, all being interviewed and talking to Angelina from KRNN. It's going to be a really fun evening. It's at Gold Town Nickelodeon. Beer and wine available, some snacks on the house, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Rain is the forecast for basically the whole week. Let's just not even go into it any further than that. Do we need to know more than that? No, it's going to rain, okay? We already know this. It's going to rain. Hey, we're listening in the background to the beautiful music of New York Polyphony, and they're going to be playing here at Thunder Mountain High School October 9th, and you can get tickets by going online at jahc.org to New York Polyphony. a beautiful quartet a cappella male group that does beautiful work, as you can hear. Well, thanks so much to my guests today on a Juno Afternoon, Dick Reichman and Charles Branklin of the Perseverance production of Mice and Men, Gary Weglars and Colleen Jones from Hospice. We really appreciate that coming by. Thanks for calling in, Jim Cosgrove, Mr. Stinky Feet, who'll be playing Sunday at JDHS Auditorium. And also thanks again to Melissa Kukesh and Nicole Hollingstead from Sea Alaska and Central Council doing their voter registration event tomorrow at 4 at the A&B Hall, the Elizabeth Perachovich Center. Thanks so much for listening in to Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein. I appreciate you tuning in today. We're going to go to NPR headlines next.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear.